Many Massachusetts colleges and universities are pleased by yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling upholding the use of race as a factor in college admissions. But that doesn't mean the legal fight over race-conscious admissions decisions is over. WBUR's Deborah Becker reports.
A Massachusetts school that's been closely watching this Supreme Court case is Harvard University. That's because it's facing a separate lawsuit alleging that its admissions policies discriminate against Asian Americans. And some say yesterday's high court ruling is going to affect that suit.
I can hear the death knell of that lawsuit.
Harvard law professor Lawrence Tribe, he's advising the school on that suit, and he says yesterday's Supreme Court ruling bolsters Harvard's argument that race is one of several factors that schools should consider in admissions decisions. Yesterday's high court ruling involved the case of Abigail Fisher, a white woman who was denied admission to the University of Texas in 2008. Fisher argued that she was rejected, while African-American applicants with lower grades and test scores were admitted. Tribe says the Fisher ruling specifically mentioned something that's directly related to the Harvard lawsuit.
One of the arguments that Abigail Fisher made was that the University of Texas program discriminated against Asian Americans. But the court was very careful to say that anecdotal evidence and inconclusive statistical evidence is not enough to make that kind of claim.
But the plaintiffs promise the Harvard suit will go forward. The group known as the Project on Fair Representation provided counsel to Fisher and is the litigant in the Harvard case. The group's president is Edward Bloom.
The Harvard lawsuit alleges that Harvard uses a quota to limit the number of Asians that it will take. The UT lawsuit merely allowed UT's continued use of race and ethnicity. Very different lawsuits, very different legal principles at stake here.
Harvard was among a dozen schools that filed friend of the court briefs in the Fisher case, saying that the benefits of a diverse student body are more important now than ever. The chancellor of Massachusetts' flagship public college, UMass Amherst, is Kumbal Sumaswamy. He praises the ruling and says it will help students better prepare for a diverse workforce and a diverse world.
All you have to look at is what has happened in our society in the last year, year and a half alone to see that we're not in a post-racial society by any means.
Chancellor Sumaswamy says UMass makes its admissions decisions based on several factors, including race. And he says the high court ruling will allow UMass to continue to try to simultaneously increase diversity and selectivity.
This allows us to focus on student success, on the real goals of diversity, without having to worry about legal challenges.
The legal debate will likely continue. The Supreme Court ruling was close. It was a 4-3 vote. Justice Elena Kagan sat out because she worked on the case while serving in the Justice Department. In his dissent, Justice Alito said the university had not demonstrated the need for race-based admissions and that its program benefited advantaged students over impoverished ones. Also, there are 8 states, including New Hampshire, that prohibit the use of race in college admissions. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker.
More now on the Brexit earthquake reverberating around the globe as Britain votes to leave the European Union. Shortly after the vote was officially announced this morning, British Prime Minister David Cameron announced that he'll resign. The news has sent markets reeling around the globe. For a look at how it could affect the U.S. and Massachusetts, we're joined now by Professor Robert Nachtstein from the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Bob.
We're seeing huge volatility in global markets this morning. Do you think there'll be an impact to the regional economy as well here?
Well, first of all, you're going to see these financial markets in some instability for a while. This is a leap into the dark, and nobody really knows quite what's going to happen next. Financial instability, of course, does affect our economy. We've seen the effects of that after the 2008 financial crisis. Now, this instability is not going to be of that magnitude, but you can still see some effects of it, I would think, in this region.
For example, Professor?
Well, for example, anytime everybody's trying to get into safe assets, everybody's trying to become, if you will, more liquid, well, that means selling stocks. And we've seen what happens when everybody tries to sell stocks at the same time. They're entering into a down market, and this has knock-on effects on people's wealth, on their ability to spend, on business ability to invest. So this can have, there's a, if you will, a financial amplifier that connects the financial system to the real economy, and in this case, it's going to be a negative feedback. So we're going to see some effects. I don't think they're going to be serious in our state, but you're going to see some effects from the financial instability.
The UK ranks seventh in the list of top buyers of exports coming from Massachusetts. Could Britain's reduced purchasing power have an effect on those exports?
It's going to have an effect, but I think the effect is going to be somewhat small in magnitude. State exports account for no more than 5 or 6% of our total gross product in the state, and that's exaggerated because some of what we export, the value added is added elsewhere outside the state, and we just do the final exporting. So that's 5%, and then there's a big difference between seventh on the list and first on the list, which is, by the way, Canada. So basically, the UK is a small part of a relatively small part of our economy, and there's going to be some effects. Some companies that export to the UK directly are going to feel the effects of this over time. And even that's uncertain because we don't know what's going to finally be negotiated with between the UK and the EU. But I expect the economic effects in the state to be small.
How might all of this affect a huge global company like General Electric, which is about to move its world headquarters to Boston, as we know?
Well, I think that anything that affects, first of all, global financial markets is going to affect GE. And my guess is that GE does do some sales into the UK, so it'll be negatively affected by this. The magnitude is uncertain to me because I don't know at a fine-grained level GE's economic relationship with the UK. But this is the entire global economy is going to feel the knock-on impacts of Britain being, quite frankly, a less wealthy country. This is going to make Britain less well off. There are some that say that Britain could even go into recession ultimately because of this, and that's going to have global impacts, and it can't help but affect a company like GE.
Does the stock volatility mean our retirement portfolios will probably take a hit in the short run?
Yes, I think so. Anybody who has a 401k, anybody who's in the stock market at all is going to, I would say, feel some negative impact from the instability. And by the way, the recipe is not to panic, to hurry up and wait, don't sell into a down market. I think markets will recover. I don't know when they will. I don't know how much the instability will affect the markets, but at this point, I think it's just a wait-and-see attitude, but it's definitely going to affect accounts such as 401ks.
All right, and then on the positive side, might cost us less to vacation in Britain and Europe, at least in the immediate future, right? Because the British pound and the euro are plummeting this morning.
That's right. At any time a foreign currency declines in value, that means the U.S. dollar buys more. So, yeah, if you're planning a trip to London or to Paris, it's going to be less expensive than you thought it was going to be.
Long run, do you see a lasting effect in Massachusetts due to this vote?
If there's going to be a lasting effect in the state, it's going to be of small magnitude. Again, because our trade relationships with the UK are a small part of a relatively small part of our economy, I don't expect the effects to be of large magnitude, but I think they could be lasting.
Professor Robert Nachtigallen from the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, thanks a lot for speaking with us this morning about the Brexit vote, Britain getting out of the European Union. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Bob.
Jaylen Brown is joining the Boston Celtics roster. The Celts used their third overall pick in the NBA draft last night to take the California forward and Pac-12 Freshman of the Year. The Celtics drafted five other players as well and traded for a future first-round pick. We're joined this morning by Kyle Draper, the pre- and post-game host for the Boston Celtics for Comcast Sportsnet New England, to talk about the Celtics' moves. Good morning, Kyle, and thanks for speaking to Morning Edition.
Thanks for having me on today.
Kyle, tell us about Jaylen Brown. What kind of player is he, and how do you think he's going to impact the Celtics?
Well, he's a super athletic player, you know, a 6'7 guy, a really strong guy, solid defender, high basketball IQ, can finish well around the rim. And I think, you know, one of the things we heard from Danny Ainge and Wick Grosbeck last night is that this guy is ready to come in and play immediately. And I think that was maybe the biggest selling point for the Celtics. They're looking for somebody that can contribute. They're trying to compete for a title now and not 3 or 4 years from now. And so Jaylen Brown, they had really high on their draft board. I know that. They brought him in for a couple of workouts. And so the only knock on him is his shooting, shot below 30%. From three-point line in college last year, his freshman year at Cal. But when you talk about a physically gifted player, a strong player, a high basketball IQ kind of guy, Jaylen Brown's that guy.
So the Celtics obviously think that he'll grow in talent. He's only 19 years old, but they must have high hopes for him.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that they mentioned last night is that, you know, in today's NBA, you need a guy that can defend multiple positions, and they think this Jaylen Brown can do that.
The Celtics had a lot of picks last night. They chose five other players. Is there someone on that list that you're pretty high on?
Yeah, you know, I got to look at some of their second-round picks, actually. You know, the two other first-round picks probably won't play for the team this year, but the two second-round picks, Demetrius Jackson out of Notre Dame, he's a point guard, kind of a feisty guard, a truly tough competitor. And then another player that some of your listeners might be familiar with, Ben Bentel, who played at Providence. They got him in the 50 range, and I think, you know, a lot of people had him higher on their board. This guy is a physical freak. He's an athlete. He can shoot the ball. He can jump out the gym. And so I think, you know, he might be the steal of the draft for the Celtics. They have high hopes for him also. They expect him to come in and compete for a roster spot.
You mentioned the Celtics' goal of trying to get to a championship fast. Do you think that what they did last night with all these picks will bring them that?
No, I don't think so, and that's probably what's disappointing to fans. We were hoping for fireworks. We were hoping for some tangible evidence that this team got truly better, and I think that's why a lot of people wanted them to make a trade to bring in a guy like Jimmy Butler from Chicago. With that being said, now this puts the pressure on the Celtics to go out there and get something done next week once free agency begins. And so you still hear about all the rumors that they're going to target Kevin Durant and some of these other players. I think, you know, while some fans might be disappointed now, this could all change next week if they land a big fish in free agency.
Kyle Draper, pre- and post-game host for the Boston Celtics for Comcast Sportsnet New England. Thanks a lot for speaking with us this morning. We appreciate it.
All right, Bob. Thanks for having me now.
It's common for theater troupes to alternate performances of two different Shakespeare plays. But at the Central Square Theater in Cambridge, the New York-based company Bedlam is now performing two different versions of the same play. WBUR's Jeremy Goodwin reports on the two completely different interpretations of Shakespeare's comedy, Twelfth Night.
Appearing in two different versions of Twelfth Night gets confusing. The five actors not only play multiple characters, but different ones in each version. One builds simply as Twelfth Night, the other taking the play's little-used subtitle, What You Will.
I'm Kelly Curran, and in Twelfth Night, I have to remember this, in Twelfth Night I play Orsino and Mariah, and in What You Will I play Sir Toby and Olivia.
It gets particularly tricky when Sir Toby and Olivia argue with each other.
By mine honor, half drunk. What is he at the gate, cousin?
A gentleman.
A gentleman? What gentleman?
There's a gentleman here.
Oh, plague of these pickled herring. Cousin, cousin, how have you come so early by this lethargy?
Lechery? I defy lechery. Oh, there's one at the gate.
I marry? What is he?
What You Will is a high-concept production, with the cast in all-white costumes, a bunch of red paint getting splattered around, and some Billie Holiday recordings mixed in. The version dubbed Twelfth Night is a bare-bones version of the play, with actors in street clothes. It emphasizes the famous comedy's melancholy side. The different interpretations make for an unusual experiment, but the concept was born from necessity. Actor-director Eric Tucker says the company originally planned to pair Twelfth Night with a play by Clifford Odets, but couldn't get the rights to perform it.
It kind of came out of a bit of an emergency situation of just, you know, needing another play. And I thought, well, let's just do it two ways. You know, it would be fun to kind of do it as differently as possible.
It's not anything that I don't think any of us would ever thought of.
Tom O'Keefe is one of the five actors in these shows.
Like, hey, we're going to do two versions of the same play. And guess what? You're not going to play the same characters.
There were a few exceptions to that. Edmund Lewis plays Malvolio in both shows. The lines are the same, but Lewis uses them to tease out different meanings. For example, the scene where Malvolio reads a forged letter that suggests the woman he works for is in love with him.
Daylight and champagne discovers not more. This is open. I do not now fool myself to let imagination jade me, for every reason excites to this, that my lady loves me. And the other way. Daylight and champagne discovers not more. This is open. I do not now fool myself to let imagination jade me, for every reason excites to this, that my lady loves me.
When Malvolio eventually realizes he's been made a fool of, Lewis's first interpretation leads us to empathize with the poor sad sack. With the other, more comic version, the audience is likelier to whoop it up when he gets his comeuppance. Maybe Twelfth Night is particularly ripe for this dual treatment. Despite its obvious humor, the play confronts the reality that joy and sadness are intertwined, that melancholy can feel good and happiness can hurt.
These plays are often played very, very funny, very ridiculous funny, and they are funny. Everyone's like looking for something. Everyone's in love with the wrong person. People are lonely. It's sad. There's death on like all over the place.
And actress Kelly Curran says the experience of seeing both shows may reveal something to audiences about the very nature of theater.
I hope it like helps people understand just sort of the extraordinary range of things that can happen in one space. You know, through if you just put one different lens on it or one different filter.
Shakespeare is open to wide interpretation. There are few stage directions or instructions about sets or costumes. Directors and actors have creative license to find different meanings in the same text. And Bedlam Theatre wants to explore the differences further with more experiments, like staging two versions of Julius Caesar with all male and all female casts. For 90.9 WBUR and The Artery, I'm Jeremy Goodwin.